Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Please welcome to the 25th anniversary of the MIT Media Lab, the CEO and chairman of Google, Eric Schmidt.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Tell you, smile? Yeah.
Big smile.
Indeed. It's great to have you here. Thanks so much for coming.
It's great here. This place spawned a lot of what I live in every day. 10 years ago, a lot of our employees, when I visited a long time ago, it's like I said, it'll never happen. It happens every day now.
So if somebody comes to you with Media Lab on their resume,
that's a good thing.
You hire them. I see.
Yeah.
You know, are you sticking around for the party?
Yes. We have a whole team here.
Oh, I see. Well,
My guess is the demos that you guys are going to see later are the future for the next 10 years.
That's great. Well, you'll probably have some attention at the party later, so I'd keep your entourage like right around you. Eric, I want to talk about the institution of Google and institutions of change and entrepreneurship. And I think we loosely use the terms entrepreneur, innovator, and discoverer in this economy. And I'm wondering if there are institutions that foster entrepreneurs and innovators and people who discover sort of basic, deep problems that may not have immediate results, or are those best worked out in separate institutions?
Well, I'm struck by a couple of things. One, we have Marvin Minsky here, who's one of my personal heroes. There are people who, in the 60s, foresaw sort of creating what we have today when they created Kendall Square and Kendall Square Research and all of that, the progenitors of modern computing. And I'm really struck when I spend time in our government how much incumbency drives no change and how this group and the culture that's represented basically in Cambridge, in Silicon Valley, and other places in America really are different. And we, because we spend so much time with each other, we assume we're the norm. We're not. We're not the norm. That's why television doesn't quite make sense to us, because what they're saying doesn't quite compute. Whereas in this case, the students, the model of the university, the funding model, their R&D centers, which are linked pretty tightly together now, really do believe in discontinuous change. So I would argue that the solutions to the problems that we have in humanity, in government, in society as a whole, will be not made by the incumbents, but rather by people like people in this room.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the difference between an entrepreneur who takes maybe existing intellectual property and takes advantage of it in the marketplace and creates a sustaining model for it as a business. An innovator is something that seems to be a hybrid between a discoverer and an entrepreneur. And then, of course, I think, you know, people who work in basic research labs like Watson, like Kendall, like Xerox PARC, like the Media Lab, are basically working on problems where there is not necessarily an expectation. What kinds of investments foster those different individuals, and do you separate that function at Google?
We try not to, because it's one of the things that's happened is it's all gotten interlinked, and these distinctions are not as important as they were. It just involves doing amazing things. And one of the things you learn as an executive is when you walk through the halls, if you ask people who are the people doing the most interesting things, everyone agrees. So it doesn't really matter how we score it. We actually just know. And I'm really struck now by my entire career started with DARPA, NSF, and the kind of funding that people, you know, the generation before me figured was important. The history of American funding of major universities, including MIT, started in the post-war period by understanding that having a robust investment in basic science, which precedes all of us, you know, what allows us to get these extraordinary returns in terms of semiconductors, it's really physics, right? And all of those investments that occurred in the 60s and 70s and 80s, we're now the beneficiaries of. So unlike our children, let's thank our parents, right? Let's actually recognize that people actually work very hard to create an opportunity that we all now benefit from.
But let's explore the frame there. They were motivated by a Cold War, almost fear mentality that we had to compete with the Russians.
Now we can be afraid of our competitors in the economic sense. Whatever works that causes more money to come to basic research is a good outcome.
But do those motives pursue or produce the same kinds of outcomes? In other words, can we formulate the same kind of urgency about investing in innovation today without a Cold War as our parents did?
Well, I would hope so. I mean, let's if you watch enough television and you spend enough time in Washington, what's the future of America? Okay, massive deficits, loss of manufacturing jobs overseas, an increasing number of healthcare services jobs which are relatively low paid, declining productivity, and aside from the brilliant aspects of our leading universities, no American leadership in anything. That's the sum of the message. So what's your answer? Your answer is innovation.
Okay. All right, but the motive there is we're failing, let's stop failing. And
let's start with advanced manufacturing jobs. Here in Cambridge, you have the largest cluster, as far as I can tell, of biotech and biologic-related businesses. That didn't occur by accident. It's not some random event that it occurred in Cambridge. It occurred because people foresaw that a cluster of such investments built around the innovation at Harvard and MIT and the various institutes that exist would create what are, in fact, millions of jobs in a leading position globally. That can be reproduced.
Not NSF, though, not DARPA, not the institutions of government and policy that were operating in the 50s and 60s.
Well, NSF and DARPA did other things. These guys' funding comes out of the National Institute for Health. The important point is, I don't care how the money happens. What I recognize is that you have young people who have an idea and they need access. There's a problem, by the way, in America that there's a valley of death, as it's called, that the leading universities, including MIT, Harvard, and others here in the Boston area, Boston University, have ideas involving, for example, nanotechnology, and they cannot get enough funding now. So it's really a national emergency in terms of trying to get these businesses built.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what Marvin Minsky used to tell me years ago, and I thought it was so clever and advanced, and it was more evidence that what I've always believed is that Marvin is actually a visitor from another planet, and it wasn't.
We'll talk about that a little bit later. Perhaps you can rebut
a little
him.
Bit later. No, but he described that what was going on at the Media Lab was actually human evolution. It wasn't the creation of tools. And Frank Wass, actually on my program this morning, referred to this network, nervous system that exists around us in the wireless domain. You've talked about something called augmented humanity.
Let me make the argument as follows. Let's fast forward a few years. Everybody here has a mobile phone at the moment, and your cameras and so forth and so on. All of these phones will follow Moore's law in these amazing ways. The phones know where they are, and they're highly personal. So what do I really want, since I'm a tourist here in Cambridge? As I walk down the street, I want the phone to, or whatever the device, tablet, to tell me, yes, you were here 2 years ago. Yes, that store is a different store. Yes, you need some new pants, Eric. Actually, your shirt's kind of dirty. Maybe you should go over there. You can buy a really good bargain. You walk into the store, and it says, by the way, just for you, Eric, here's a 10% off coupon if you buy right now. Now, this is all with my permission, by the way, all something that I choose to do, and it remembers that. Now, today, how does that work for me as an executive? I have an assistant who remembers what hotels I like and where I'm going and sort of keeps me and tells me, you're late, as usual, get over here. Why can't the device, why can't the network sort of know that and help me if I want it to? Right? That's the possibility that this new model describes. I'm quite convinced that what we call hyperlocal, sort of local mobile social, has a set of killer applications. I'm also quite convinced that the Media Lab has some very interesting ideas in this space that can help us with it.
And to note the difference between an individual who has that capability and an individual who doesn't have that capability at this point, just note the difference between Eric and my shoes this morning or this afternoon.
That's
pretty easy.
Now, one of the comments about computers is we always get confused about what computers are good at. Computers are not very good at feeling, judgment, emotion, although people are working on those. Computers are extremely good at dealing with billions of things of information and doing various forms of calculations that produce interesting results. Because computers can remember everything, and humans can remember almost nothing, especially as you get older, right? So the fact of the matter is that society will change based on the fact that computers are very good at what they're good at, and computers and people are still very good at what we're good at. And by the way, remember that most of the machine learning algorithms learn from people, right? You train them. So ideally what will happen is that in this sort of, however you want to call it, but in this collaboration between this emergent amount of machine technology and the human condition, the collaboration is helpful to both, right? That humans can train computers, and computers can help humans live their lives better. I would argue, in fact, that the goal needs to be set completely differently than the way it's... Normally, the goal has been set to use computers more. I would argue that the goal is to use computers less, right? That, in fact, the computer is just around if you need it, and otherwise you are free to actually do what humans like to do, which is to have a good time, be productive, care about your family, or what have you, right? And then, in fact, that the sort of the hours that I spent reprogramming my PC in Windows 7, you know, over the weekend is not a very good use of my time. You know, why I chose to do that is a separate problem involving my judgment.
Yes.
But the fact of the matter
yes,
is,
I would say, yes.
You know, and I would argue that if you take a look, at the iPad, part of the reason it's so successful is precisely because it works so simply, and it just works. And that the just works option, which I think has been pioneered here and a couple of other places, is in fact a new discovery for most computer scientists. And Google, of course, is also trying to do the just works in its businesses as well.
There are people who can help you with your judgment problem in this room, probably, and you may hear from them later on today. Two questions, a personal one, and one I think that is more global about the identity of Google today. I've always wanted to ask you this, Eric. What do you do when you absolutely don't want to be distracted?
Turn your computer off.
Right, but then you have to actually do something as well.
I read a book.
There we go.
I know it's boring. I actually also read a newspaper, a physical newspaper. I know it's going out of style.
Such a chucklehead. Man. Newspapers and books.
Newspapers
love
and
that.
Books. You know, you
gotta love
read
that.
Stuff.
Yes. Yeah, the man
I also listen to music.
Yeah. You're a public radio fan too.
Yes.
Yes, that's I'm glad of that.
I listen to public radio and on podcasts.
There we go.
Turns out your show and virtually everything else is now highly searchable.
Indeed, and the tipping points of whether people listen to things time-shifted or in the broadcast medium is rapidly approaching for each
individual
medium.
What's interesting
is
that debate is not a debate that's interesting to most people. It's a debate that's fascinating to the media industry. The average person now lives in a world of infinite choice of information. They carry it around with them, and they listen to it when they want to.
No, absolutely.
It seems pretty straightforward.
So the no, and I agree. But today, in your announcement of quarterly earnings, you reported $1 billion revenue in the mobile space. Is that a tipping point?
Well,
advertising revenue.
Anything that's $1 billion is good, and anything that's growing fast, and anything that's growing
let me
quickly
just
is even,
write
is
that
even better.
Down.
A simple rule for those of you who are CEOs is that rising revenue solves all known problems.
Let's focus on that then for a moment. I think it's fair to say that in the 21st century, you are one of the few figures who we might compare with individuals from the classic Gilded Age of America a century ago.
Okay.
And that is both a responsibility and probably an annoyance.
Although I would argue Wall Street is top of the list.
Probably, yes. Yeah. In the case of the Gilded Age, most of the individuals who ran big institutions, big corporations, were monopolies. I think you, probably unique to the individuals that we're speaking of in this room, represent something that could possibly be called monopoly, but is maybe something more nuanced, ubiquity. Google has ubiquity. Monopolies are something different. Microsoft is a monopoly, or was a monopoly at one point. Hello, argument.
Was found guilty of being
exactly. Was found guilty of being a monopoly, actually.
just to get the facts straight.
Yeah. Something that you don't like to point out in crowds of people in public.
Oh, I think do a Google search.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Right. On your own.
Is ubiquity, because a lot of people have described monopolies as being a non-innovative mode, that monopolies tend to become risk averse and have difficulty with innovation. Is ubiquity something different? Does the social network capability of being ubiquitous allow you an innovative capacity that has perhaps not existed before?
We don't phrase it that way, but I'm happy with the phrasing that you described. What we phrase it as, just focus on the user and all else will work. So we don't spend an awful lot of time. The classic thing that happens is people who have MBA degrees show up and they say, like, where is the revenue plan? Okay, where is your business plan? Where is your ROI calculation and so forth? And those are hard to find. What you find is a very, very strong focus on getting more users to use stuff. And if you can get enough users to use stuff, you can make money doing it. And so philosophically, that aligns us with end user interests, we hope. And it also aligns us with scale. So you have an end-user-focused business that scales rapidly, which I think is ultimately the way you express the ubiquity point. The problem with monopoly is that monopoly ultimately allows you to put you in opposition to the goals of your end user, because ultimately end users, in fact, do want choice. Right? They want, and indeed, we do lots of things to prevent us from being a monopoly. We allow people to take their data wherever they want, and if they become dissatisfied with us, and it's an internal check and balance on our own power.
We want to open it to questions from you, so prepare yours, call, raise your hands, call out your question. I will repeat it so everyone can hear it. We'll do that in just a moment. Does Google have a foreign policy?
Well, you can see how well it worked in China. You know, one day somebody said, well, finally, you know, one of your politicians in Boston said, Google versus China, finally an equal match. Well, you saw what happened. We take a particular view on information, which is, I think, a Western view, and I think most Western countries would agree with it. What I've learned is there are an awful lot of countries that don't like our view. China, obviously, because of the censorship rules, but there are others. Typical example would be that a bad video gets uploaded, we take it down, and then YouTube gets blocked for a year. Now, that could be because we so annoy the leaders of that country that they're punishing us. An alternative hypothesis, you always want to have an alternative hypothesis in a PhD program, is that perhaps those leaders are embarrassed by the multiplicity of YouTube videos critical of their leadership. So we're never really quite sure. So we've taken the position that ultimately, if you want to play in the modern world, you have to be pretty information transparent. We believe in transparency and open access, and that gets us into trouble, but it is what we believe.
The world population in 1800 was about 2 billion, which is estimated to be the amount of people or the number of people who are actively online in the world today. What would that world look like when 6 to 8 billion are online, and what will Google look like in that case?
One of the things that I am personally proudest of, and I hope you are all as well, is the number of people who have come into the global conversation who literally had no choice without the success of the internet and telecommunications revolution. So I am beyond excited that there's on the order of 4 billion mobile phones, most of which are the feature phones, the less capable phones. I'm beyond excited that there are 800 million to a billion smartphones. And I'm even more excited that another generation of phones is coming, which is going to hit that $30, $50, $60 price point, which allows you to get another billion of those phones out into the market. So what happens when you have a powerful browser in the hands of people who've never seen anything except maybe a television in a shared model? We haven't heard from them. We don't really know what they think. I personally believe they all care about Britney Spears, and I think we're going to discover that. But we don't know, right? Probably means greater global brands. It probably also means greater global access, and it also means that we may hear from them and we hear what their lives are like. In the same way that CNN in the 70s and 80s exposed the horrific conditions of people that we could never see before, and television bring those images directly to you, now these people have phones and video cameras, and they can record both the good aspects of their culture but also the terrible situations that, for example, women are taken that are put in the third world. And I think it leads to, the transparency leads to, the openness leads ultimately to making the world a better place.
So you would say, and this is a very positive note that I wasn't necessarily expecting, that because of precisely that, the possibilities for a huge corporation like Google to take steps in hearing those individuals beginning to join this community and taking steps to improve their lives, the opportunity to do good, even as a ubiquitous near monopoly, is as good as it's ever been.
Well, the goal of the company is to do good. And so it's only a good thing when people have access to broadband. So an example would be the rollout of 4G in the Western world, in Europe and in the United States. Trust me, the people at the Media Lab will figure out what to do with 10 megabits with low latency that's continuously streamed to your tablet and phone. Trust me, we can use that. I'm not worried about that. Same argument about people who've never had access before. What will they do? Well, I mean, we think they're all going to spend their time checking for crop yield and so forth. A much more likely scenario is they're going to be heavily obsessed with entertainment because they're human beings and people are the same everywhere. So that, again, is, in my view, a positive
positive effect of this. And our business approach is to get them wired and then not worry too much about what happens after that, because they're clever and these platforms work. And eventually there will be business opportunities 5, 10, 20 years from now, which will be massive, right?
As long as you're listening.
Well, we better be.
And that's the key.
But more importantly, we have enough capital as a corporation to invest into that market. And we have the patience to understand that people are the same everywhere. People actually want connectivity everywhere. And that connectivity will benefit them in education and access. It will force their governments to become more transparent, even in these horrific dictatorships that exist. And it's an overwhelmingly positive message. And what happens is people say, oh, well, as a result, some evil person will have voice. Yeah, well, the principle of free speech is that evil voices are overwhelmed by the good voices. And I live in a world, and I spend an awful lot of time with every day, I'll tell you that the overall human condition is a very positive one. That the average person I deal with really does want to make the world a better place, and we can all participate in delivering that. It's a great message.
Eric Schmidt, thank you so much. Hands up. Stand, please. What's Google's education policy? Will we see Google High School? We already have Google University.
We're working on our strategy there. As you know, if you go back to the Nation at Risk book from 1982, 1983, I believe, the problems of education in America are profound. They're complicated. I would observe that much of the education establishment seems to be organized around the education establishment and not measurable outcomes with regard to the children. So speaking as a businessman, I would start by measuring the outcomes and then iterating and trying to make things better. The contribution that Google can provide is a number. We worked hard to get the schools wired, and I, in an earlier job, did that as well. So getting the schools wired, getting the teachers empowered with access to the internet, getting mobile phones into that are all very, very important. A further thing that we can do is try to promote the use of video and other information sources to help advance education, especially for people who don't have access to very good teachers. There are, for example, people who are remarkably generous, and they're funding YouTube videos of the best teachers so that you can actually see that and see that for free anywhere in the world. And what I want to think about is you've got some brilliant student who's isolated in some rural part of our country who has a broadband connection and not very many people to talk to. I want that person to be able to get the same level of education that I could get. And I think that's a good goal. So those are some of the things that we're working on. I'm looking for even stronger, technologically intensive education ideas, and if you have them, we'd like to hear them. Most of the ideas that are been discussed about education, I think, are pretty much dealing with the incumbencies and the existing things rather than thinking of completely new ways of affecting education.
Question from up here. Speak up now.
Okay. I wanted to thank you for all of your comments, but specifically the ones about incumbency and how to bring innovation in, and that how current forces kind of fight against it. One of the things that's made the Media Lab really a great place since its start is small research groups working together, fostering innovation, but still communicating as a whole. Does that model break down when you get to something the size of Google, and how do you see how that kind of grassroots innovation can really be fostered all the way up to the top where it can be visible and make a difference?
I think the Media Lab is certainly one of the first institutions that I knew that came back and basically argued that you had to break down the stovepipes that existed in academia. And the Media Lab, to me, 25 years ago, you know, Nicholas and sort of the usual suspects sort of foresaw the need for breaking that down. And my guess is in other industries there are other people who also saw that. But I think it's axiomatic now that you're not going to get something interesting unless you build these teams. The problem with organizations is there has to be a hierarchy, there has to be a boss, there has to be a building, and so forth and so on. We try to break that down inside of our culture, but we have the same problems. They're not as obvious, and we talk about it a lot. But I think that ultimately the reason incumbencies break down is because of strong entrepreneurship, strong leaders, and people who are willing to hear no a lot. And if you look at the Silicon Valley sort of archetype, it's a person who is young, rejects existing orthodoxies,
and is willing to put heart, body, and soul into making something happen. And we celebrate the winners, but remember, there's lots of losers too, and that's part of the system. The typical venture investment is a 1 in 10 is successful. The typical Google scale investment is 1 in 100 to 1 in 1,000, which is just how the economics work. So it's important to remember that we have a lot of people who are trying very hard. A few succeed, but we want to celebrate everybody who tries to change something. It's that changing, that yearning for change that I think drives society so fundamentally better.
How many in this room have heard the word no a lot? Clap if you have.
All the entrepreneurs. Just try to raise money in the last year and a half. You understand what I'm talking about.
Right, indeed. Question right here in the front. How is expensive journalism going to be paid for if, as Eric has suggested, people are going to be hugely interested in Britney Spears, perhaps, in the future, and other entertainment models?
We all benefited from a unique combination of events. Strong classified revenues for newspapers, local pseudo-monopolies where the local news was only really under the hands of one or two providers, the emergence of print advertising and so forth, and the fact that people just like to read and read physical newspapers. All of those trends, and magazines as well, all of those trends, as you know, have been under tremendous attack, and it's a real loss for, I think, vibrant society. So what would happen is those models would essentially throw off a public good, which was the ability to fund investigative journalism. There have been a couple of proposals of how to replace that. A number of, again, very generous people have funded nonprofits, which attempt to fund that public good. A number of the newspapers are doing well enough that they'll clearly survive any, they've become national, essentially, and they'll clearly have enough to continue to fund that public good. But there's a clear loss of voices. When you talk to the folks in the media industry, there's a lot of excitement about subscription models because they're used to subscription models. So from a Google perspective, we want to empower their subscription models, and we want to let between the publisher and the consumer, they can figure out, is this information that's going to be, people will subscribe for it, or whether it's going to be advertising supported. So the restructuring is dramatic. It's incredibly painful. There are models that are successful. Huffington Post is an example of a Google partner that I think people here know, which appears to be doing quite well in an advertising model. So there are mechanisms which do work, which ultimately I think will generate enough profit that they'll be able to fund that public good.
Is that hybridizing, though, the subscription model and the advertising model, in the sense that people talk about journalistic institutions as communities, NPR, for instance, being a community? It's a kind of a subscription model. You sign up to be a part of the community. Yes, there's revenue as a result of that. Huffington Post has a community aspect to it in addition to being this advertising. Are those merging ultimately?
They are, but I would rather, again, we always talk about the incumbents. I'd rather talk about the end user, right? Because the end user will ultimately determine the outcome of this, and let's talk about what the end user is going to do. Today, I read the physical newspaper. 5 to 10 years from now, I'll have this incredibly intelligent tablet, which will have every aspect of the newspaper that I care about, except maybe that grainy feel and then the stuff on my hands. But what's important about that content is it will know who I am. It will remember what I read. It will suggest things that I should know. We can actually, using algorithms now, suggest serendipity. We can find related stories and stories that you should know about. And furthermore, we can do very sophisticated advertising on such a device. We can do advertising that's targeted at you. Today, people here, those of you who read a newspaper this morning, I did. Right? Does anybody remember the actual physical ads in the newspaper? Typically not. It's hard to sort of remember. And they are there. You just went by them. Whereas we can generate ads that are so good, so targeted, that you will remember. And we hope that they will help pay for the quality of the content that you're getting.
What's the responsibility of an institution like Google, though, to lower the cost of entry? A newspaper has a low cost of entry. People can be civically engaged and get the information about their world at a low cost. If everything's on a tablet, certain people will be able to pay that cost of entry. Others will not. Is that Google's responsibility to lower that cost of entry?
Well, we would argue that since almost everything on Google is free for end users, that's a pretty good responsibility right there. I mean, the fact that basically we don't charge for access to this information, and we're not planning on, and I suspect we never will, is probably a pretty good starting point.
Question right here.
Yeah.
What mechanisms do you use to listen to users? Do you employ particular strategies to make sure you're getting the right signal?
There's ultimately an inventor. And it goes like this. The inventor walks into my office and says, I have a brilliant product, and I built it, and it's going to do great. And I say, wonderful. I completely agree with you. And then we measure them to the nanosecond. And if the slope is a hockey stick up like that, they're a brilliant inventor. And if the slope is like this, they get canceled. Right? And then, by the way, we ask them to do it again. Because it's great to have an inventor who's failed once. Right? Because they really are a lot more humble to start with, and they listen a lot better. You need the input from the end user, but you need the inventor with the passion. If you listen to the end user, they'll just give you a jumble of feedback. You need that person who has that creative spark. And by person, sometimes it's a team. Sometimes it's a group. Sometimes it's a set of things. In our case, we do a tremendous amount of basically blind testing along the way. So we really insist on the state of the art in terms of user testing. We have all sorts of ways in which we do that. And then the most important thing is we typically do what we call dog food, you know, eat your own dog food. So we test the stuff internally, and then we roll it out to friends. And my guess is if we took the union of you all in this room and 10 of your friends, if you all and 10 of your friends like something, that's a pretty good predictor for pretty much everybody, right? If we could invent such a great product.
But if, okay, right here. Will Google ever create its own content? It up till now rides on mainstream media in presenting news.
Yeah, the term "ride on the back of" is a sort of loaded question. And so when I'm asked that question, it's usually in the context of, and therefore you should pay me a lot of money for my content. So, no, I understand. I want to be clear on that. What we do with the mainstream media is we send a tremendous amount of traffic to their websites. And so each of them has an opportunity to actually not accept that traffic. They can actually choose not to do that, but they all choose to do it. So we have this conversation all the time. Furthermore, what we do is we provide advertising model and to some degree subscription models, which allow them to then sell that content. And that's, I think, how we do it. With respect to doing our own content, we've typically found that there's a line there that we should not cross, that it's better to let the content folks do the content and have us basically provide the platform, the monetization, and so forth, partly because the company's run by computer scientists, and as arrogant as we are, we're not necessarily so good at these other businesses. And the second thing is it's better to have the competition among the content players for the end user voice. As I said, we've typically not gone across that, although we enable end users to create a lot of content and let the market sort it out.
Questions on the mystifyingly silent middle section here? Anything? Any questions from... No? Would you call denying access to content that has been criticized in countries where you've worked a form of content creation in the sense that you're negatively selecting what gets seen?
Well, again, I'm not sure what you're referring to, because if you're referring to China, we actually took a very pro-content position.
I'm referring much more generally. If you're in the position of taking stuff down or having to make that choice, not content creation?
No, it's not. It's under duress and under a threat of a gun. You know, one way to understand it is that every country, I've now learned this the hard way, every country has the same debate we have about free speech and what is permitted content and so forth. And at least in this sort of democratically or the pseudo-democratically thing, they have a process which involves rule of law. And so we have learned the hard way is that we have to respect their rule of law even if we disagree with it. But we do our very best to publicize when this is occurring. So if you disagree about a policy in a foreign country, because the countries, we are subject to their laws, they can actually arrest and imprison our employees, we are forced to operate under their laws, even if we disagree with them.
Okay. It's been great, the time that you've spent with us. It's really thrilling. I think we're going to sort of wind up with one more question right here.
Well,
is there a class of information that you expect never to be able to find on Google?
Well, hopefully the information that you choose not to give Google, which would be information, right? That would be the simplest answer.
Well, what about the number of people who died today from malaria?
Well, presumably that's a publicly knowable question.
In a month, not today.
Well, but in theory, we like...
There are limitations that because of your restrictions, but there are also limitations
There are all sorts of laws about this. There is, for example, a law that limits the aperture of the satellites that we can launch to take pictures for Google Earth. And that's a limit. That's one that's imposed on us by U.S. law, which we're just subject to. So there's a category of those. But I think the most important message is anything that's publicly accessible... That's again, legitimate and legal, we would like you to be able to find out instantaneously. That's about information access. Information that is private should remain private. And I hope that that's a clear answer.
Google, when the company was formed, was a huge number, right?
Google, yes. Yes. 10 to the 100th.
Yes.
Still
now,
a large number.
Now it's a verb in addition to
it's
being a number.
Still also a very large number.
Right. What will it be in 25 years, do you think?
You mean it'll still be a very large number? We did the math.
That much is true.
We did the math of how big 10 to the 100th is. And just for those of you who are not so technical, it's not the same thing as like multiplying. It's a very, very large number. It's much larger than the number of proteins and electrons and so forth in the universe.
So if a billion is always a good thing, a Google is always a really, 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 really good thing.
Yeah, so what happens is it's a billion, it's basically exabytes and petabytes and zettabytes and yettabytes and so forth. And we've got a long way to go before we get to Google. I think one of the things to remember is do a little bit of compounding. And humans are very, very bad with compounding. So let's do a little math. Here we are at MIT and so forth and so on. So Moore's Law is doubling every 18 months. Most people believe Moore's Law can continue for another 10 to 20 years. We're always projecting the end of Moore's Law, but the physicists and chemists and so forth are doing amazing things with parallelism. So 10 to the 18th is roughly an increase of 1,000. Let's do the math. Roughly 105 years, which means roughly... 10,000 in, did I get that right? No. So I think it's 10,000 in 10 years. So in 15 years, how much time is that? Do the math. So all of a sudden, the underlying computation, everything we see today in 10 to 15 years will be that many more orders of magnitude of information and access and speed. So if everything is 10,000 times faster, cheaper, more prevalent, what does that alter in art? Well, that's why I come back and I argue about computers will remember pretty much everything that you let them remember, will pretty much know what everything is up to in terms of things that want to publish with it. There'll be a very, very large number of devices. These are activities that the Media Lab is working on a lot, and that we'll sort of take all of this for granted. And I think all of us are planning on being alive in the next 10 to 15 years, so hopefully we're all going to be part of this, and we're all going to see it. And I would argue that society has to really think about what it means to have all of these things. This is a question far beyond the pay grade of Google or of anybody here in the room. What does it mean to have this kind of access, this kind of information? I'm quite convinced it's all positive, but I suspect it has a lot of surprises.
You're roughly how old?
55.
You will retire when your job ceases to be blank.
Well, we've actually agreed that I have to stay at Google with Larry and Sergey for a very long time.
But just personally, I'll stop doing this lousy job when it stops being blank.
My current plan is to do it when I keel over, which hopefully will be a long time from now, because the opportunity to empower people with information is the opportunity of a lifetime. I would argue that within your career and the things that you do it. You don't have to do this anymore. You do it because you enjoy it and because you have a huge impact. And for me personally, the opportunity to serve the interests of broad access to information for the 6 billion is a trip. I mean, Megan, who's one of your stellar graduates here, and I were talking about Google App Engine, Google Earth Engine, basically, as an opportunity to take Google Earth and instrument it and make it dynamic, right? And then take programs and feeds from everyone so you can see the impact of what's happening to the world that is the only world we have and the world that we all love. It's a tremendous opportunity for all of us, and I love to be part of it.
And you're innovating from within at Google. Absolutely. To make it possible. Eric Schmidt, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, great.